to Nefud.
"The Colonel Bashar is to see everything at once. Take him in by the door where you stood, Nefud."
"This way, sir," Nefud said. Slowly, insolently, the Sardaukar moved around the Baron, shouldered away through the guardsmen. Insufferable, the Baron thought. Now the Emperor will know how I slipped up. He'll recognize it as a sign of weakness. And it was agonizing to realize that the Emperor and his Sardaukar were alike in their disdain for weakness. The Baron chewed at his lower lip, consoling himself that the Emperor at least had not learned of the Atreides' raid on Gedi Prime, the destruction of the Harkonnen spice stores there.
Damn that slippery Duke!
The Baron watched the retreating backs, the arrogant Sardaukar and the stocky, efficient Nefud.
We must adjust, the Baron thought. I'll have to put Rabban over this damnable planet once more. Without restraint, I must spend my own Harkonnen blood to put Arrakis into a proper condition for accepting Fade Rautha. Damn that piter! He would get himself killed before I was through with him.
The Baron sighed.
And I must send at once to Tlaelax for a new Mentat. They undoubtedly have the new one ready for me by now.
One of the guardsmen beside him coughed. The Baron turned toward the man.
I'm hungry.
Yes, my lord.
And I wish to be diverted while you're clearing out that room and studying its secrets for me.
The Baron rumbled. The guardsman lowered his eyes.
What diversion does my lord wish?
I'll be in my sleeping chambers, the Baron said. Bring me that young fellow we bought on Gamont, the one with the lovely eyes. Drag him well. I don't feel like wrestling. Yes, my lord.
The Baron turned away, began moving with his bouncing, suspenser-buoyed pace toward his chambers.
Yes, he thought, the one with the lovely eyes. The one who looks so much like the young Paul Atreides.
O.C.s of Caladan, O people of Duke Leto, citadel of Leto fallen, fallen forever. From Songs of Muad'Dib by the Princess Irulan.
Paul felt that all his past, every experience before this night, had become sand, curling in an hourglass. He sat near his mother, hugging his knees within a small fabric and plastic hutment, a still tent that had come, like the Fremen clothing they now wore, from the pack left in the Thopter. There was no doubt in Paul's mind who had put the Fremkit there, who had directed the course of the Thopter carrying them captive. Yui. The traitor doctor had sent them directly into the hands of Duncan Idaho. Paul stared out the transparent end of the still tent at the moon-shadowed rocks that ringed this place where Idaho had hidden them. Hidden like a child when I'm now the Duke, Paul thought. He felt the thought gall him, but he could not deny the wisdom in what they did. Something had happened to his awareness this night. He saw with sharpened clarity every circumstance and occurrence around him. He felt unable to stop the inflow of data or the cold precision with which each new item was added to his knowledge and the computation was centered in his awareness. It was Mentat power and more. Paul thought back to the moment of impotent rage as the strange Thopter dived out of the night onto them, swooping like a giant hawk above the desert with wind screaming through its wings. The thing in Paul's mind had happened then. The Thopter had skidded and slewed across a sand ridge toward the running figures, his mother and himself. Paul remembered how the smell of burned sulphur from abrasion of Thopter skids against sand had drifted across them. His mother, he knew, had turned, expected to meet a lasgun in the hands of Harkonnen mercenaries, and had recognized Duncan Idaho leaning out the Thopter's open door, shouting,
"Hurry! There's worm signs south of you!"
But Paul had known as he turned who piloted the Thopter. An accumulation of minutiae in the way it was flown, the dash of the landing, clues so small, even his mother hadn't detected them, had told Paul precisely who sat at those controls. Across the still tent from Paul, Jessica stirred, said,
There can be only one explanation. The Harkonnens held Yue's wife. He hated the Harkonnens. I cannot be wrong about that. You read his note. But why has he saved us from the carnage?
She is only now seeing it, and that poorly, Paul thought. The thought wasn't a shock. He had known this fact as a by-the-way thing while reading the note that had accompanied the ducal signet in the pack.
"Do not try to forgive me," Yue had written. "I do not want your forgiveness. I already have enough burdens. What I have done was done without malice or hope of another's understanding. It is my own Tahadi al-Burhan, my ultimate test. I give you the Atreides ducal signet as token that I write truly. By the time you read this, Duke Leto will be dead. Take consolation from my assurance that he did not die alone, that one we hate above all others died with him."
It had not been addressed or signed, but there'd been no mistaking the familiar scrawl. Yue's. Remembering the letter, Paul re-examined the distress of that moment, a thing sharp and strange that seemed to happen outside his new mental alertness. He had read that his father was dead, known the truth of the words, but had felt them as no more than another datum to be entered in his mind and used.
"I loved my father," Paul thought, "and knew this for truth. I should mourn him. I should feel something."
But he felt nothing except, here's an important fact. It was one with all the other facts. All the while his mind was adding sense impressions, extrapolating, computing. Halleck's words came back to Paul.
"Mood's a thing for cattle or for making love. You fight when the necessity arises, no matter your mood."
Perhaps that's it, Paul thought. I'll mourn my father later, when there's time.
But he felt no let-up in the cold precision of his being. He sensed that his new awareness was only a beginning, that it was growing. The sense of terrible purpose he'd first experienced in his ordeal with the Reverend Mother Gaius Helen Mohiam pervaded him. His right hand, the hand of remembered pain, tingled and throbbed.
"Is this what it is to be the Kwisatz Haderach?" he wondered. "For a while I thought Howard had failed us again," Jessica said. "I thought perhaps Yue wasn't a Sook doctor."
"He was everything we thought him, and more," Paul said. And he thought, why is she so slow seeing these things? He said, "If Idaho doesn't get through to Kynes, we'll be—"
"He's not our only hope," she said.
"Such was not my suggestion," he said. She heard the steel in his voice, the sense of command, and stared across the grey darkness of the still tent at him. Paul was a silhouette against moon-frosted rocks, seen through the tent's transparent end.
"Others among your father's men will have escaped," she said. "We must regather them, find—"
"We will depend upon ourselves," he said. "Our immediate concern is our family atomics. We must get them before the Harkonnens can search them out."
"Not likely they'll be found," she said. "The way they were hidden.
It must not be left to chance." And she thought, blackmail with the family atomics as a threat to the planet and its spice. That's what he has in mind. But all he can hope for then is escape into renegade anonymity. His mother's words had provoked another train of thought in Paul, a duke's concern for all the people they'd lost this night. People are the true strength of a great house, Paul thought. And he remembered Howard's words. Parting with people is a sadness. A place is only a place.
They're using Sarduka, Jessica said. We must wait until the Sarduka have been withdrawn.
They think us caught between the desert and the Sarduka, Paul said. They intend that there be no Atreides survivors. Total extermination. Do not count on any of our people escaping.
They cannot go on indefinitely risking exposure of the Emperor's part in this.
Can't they?
Some of our people are bound to escape.
Are they? Jessica turned away, frightened of the bitter strength in her son's voice, hearing the precise assessment of chances. She sensed that his mind had leaped ahead of her,
that it now saw more in some respects than she did. She had helped train the intelligence which did this, but now she found herself fearful of it. Her thoughts turned, seeking toward the lost sanctuary of her duke, and tears burned her eyes. "This is the way it had to be, Leto," she thought. "A time of love and a time of grief." She rested her hand on her abdomen, awareness focused on the embryo there. "I have the Atreides' daughter I was ordered to produce. But the Reverend Mother was wrong. A daughter wouldn't have saved my Leto. This child is only life reaching for the future in the midst of death. I conceived out of instinct and not out of obedience."
"Try the Communinet receiver again," Paul said.
"The mind goes on working no matter how we try to hold it back," she thought.
Jessica found the tiny receiver Idaho had left for them, flipped its switch. A green light glowed on the instrument's face. Tinny screeching came from its speaker. She reduced the volume, hunted across the bands. A voice speaking Atreides battle language came into the tent.
"Back and regroup at the ridge. Fedor reports no survivors in Karthag, and the Guild Bank has been sacked."
Karthag, Jessica thought. That was a Harkonnen hotbed.
"There's Sardauka," the voice said. "Watch out for Sardauka in Atreides uniforms. They're—"
A roaring filled the speaker. Then silence.
"Try the other bands," Paul said.
"Do you realize what that means?"
Jessica asked.
"I expected it. They want the Guild to blame us for destruction of their bank. With the Guild against us, we are trapped on Arrakis. Try the other bands."
She weighed his words.
"I expected it."
What had happened to him? Slowly, Jessica returned to the instrument. As she moved the band slide, they caught glimpses of violence in the few voices calling out in Atreides' battle language.
"Fall back! Try to regroup it! Trapped in a cave at—"
And there was no mistaking the victorious exultation in the Harkonnen gibberish that poured from the other bands. Sharp commands, battle reports. There wasn't enough of it for Jessica to register and break the language, but the tone was obvious. Harkonnen victory. Paul shook the pack beside him, hearing the 2 litajons of water gurgle there. He took a deep breath, looked up through the transparent end of the tent at the rock escarpment outlined against the stars. His left hand felt the sphincter seal of the tent's entrance.
"It'll be dawn soon," he said. "We can wait through the day for Idaho, but not through another night. In the desert you must travel by night and rest in shade through the day."
Remembered lore insinuated itself into Jessica's mind. Without a stillsuit, a man sitting in shade on the desert needs 5 liters of water a day to maintain body weight. She felt the slick soft skin of the stillsuit against her body, thinking how their lives depended on these garments.
"If we leave here, Idaho can't find us," she said.
"There are ways to make any man talk," he said. "If Idaho hasn't returned by dawn, we must consider the possibility he has been captured. How long do you think he could hold out?"
The question required no answer, and she sat in silence. Paul lifted the seal on the pack, pulled out a tiny micro-manual with glow tab and magnifier. Green and orange letters leaped up at him from the pages. Litajons, still tent, energy caps, recaths, sand snork, binoculars, stillsuit rep kit, Baradai pistol, sink chart, filt plugs, paracompass, maker hooks, thumpers, frem kit, fire pillar. So many things for survival on the desert. Presently he put the manual aside on the tent floor.
"Where can we possibly go?" Jessica asked.
"My father spoke of desert power," Paul said. "The Harkonnens cannot rule this planet without it. They've never ruled this planet, nor shall they. Not even with 10,000 legions of Sardauka."
"Paul, you can't think that—"
"We've all the evidence in our hands," he said. "Right here in this tent. The tent itself, this pack and its contents, these still suits. We know the Guild wants a prohibitive price for weather satellites. We know that—"
"What have weather satellites got to do with it?" she asked.
"They couldn't possibly—"
She broke off. Paul sensed the hyper-alertness of his mind reading her reactions, computing on minutiae.
"You see it now," he said.
Satellites watch the terrain below. There are things in the deep desert that will not bear frequent inspection.
You're suggesting the Guild itself controls this planet?
She was so slow.
No, he said. The Fremen. They're paying the Guild for privacy. Paying in a coin that's freely available to anyone with desert power. Spice. This is more than a second approximation answer. It's the straight-line computation. Depend on it.
Paul, Jessica said, you're not a Mentat yet. You can't know for sure how...
I'll never be a Mentat, he said. I'm something else. A freak.
Paul, how can you say such...
Leave me alone!
He turned away from her, looking out into the night.
Why can't I mourn?
He wondered. He felt that every fibre of his being craved this release, but it would be denied him forever. Jessica had never heard such distress in her son's voice. She wanted to reach out to him, hold him, comfort him, help him. But she sensed there was nothing she could do. He had to solve this problem by himself. The glowing tab of the Fremkit manual between them on the tent floor caught her eye. She lifted it, glanced at the flyleaf, reading, Manual of the Friendly Desert, the place full of life. Here are the Ayat and Burhan of life. Believe and Allah shall never burn you.
It reads like the Ajar book, she thought, recalling her studies of the great secrets. Has a manipulator of religions been on Arrakis?
Paul lifted the paracompass from the pack, returned it, said,
Think of all these special application Fremen machines. They show unrivaled sophistication. Admit it. The culture that made these things betrays depths no one suspected.
Hesitating, still worried by the harshness in his voice, Jessica returned to the book, studied an illustrated constellation from the Arakeen sky. Muad'Dib, the mouse, and noted that the tail pointed north. Paul stared into the tent's darkness at the dimly discerned movements of his mother, revealed by the manual's glow tap. Now is the time to carry out my father's wish, he thought. I must give her his message now while she has time for grief. Grief would inconvenience us later. And he found himself shocked by precise logic.
Mother, he said.
Yes.
She heard the change in his voice, felt coldness in her entrails at the sound. Never had she heard such harsh control.
My father is dead, he said.
She searched within herself for the coupling of fact and fact and fact, the Bene Gesserit way of assessing data, and it came to her, the sensation of terrifying loss. Jessica nodded, unable to speak.
My father charged me once, Paul said, to give you a message if anything happened to him. He feared you might believe he distrusted you.
That useless suspicion, she thought.
He wanted you to know he never suspected you, Paul said,
and explained the deception, adding, He wanted you to know he always trusted you completely, always loved you and cherished you. He said he would sooner have mistrusted himself, and he had but one regret, that he never made you his duchess. She brushed the tears coursing down her cheeks, thought, What a stupid waste of the body's water. But she knew this thought for what it was, the attempt to retreat from grief into anger.
Leto, my Leto, she thought, what terrible things we do to those we love.
With a violent motion she extinguished the little manual's glow tab. Sobs shook her. Paul heard his mother's grief and felt the emptiness within himself.
I have no grief, he thought. Why? Why?
He felt the inability to grieve as a terrible flaw.
A time to get and time to lose, Jessica thought,
quoting to herself from the OC Bible.
A time to keep and a time to cast away. A time for love and a time to hate. A time of war and a time of peace.
Paul's mind had gone on in its chilling precision. He saw the avenues ahead of them on this hostile planet. Without even the safety valve of dreaming, he focused his prescient awareness, seeing it as a computation of most probable futures, but with something more, an edge of mystery, as though his mind dipped into some timeless stratum and sampled the winds of the future. Abruptly, as though he had found a necessary key, Paul's mind climbed another notch in awareness. He felt himself clinging to this new level, clutching at a precarious hold and peering about. It was as though he existed within a globe, with avenues radiating away in all directions. Yet this only approximated the sensation. He remembered once seeing a gauze kerchief blowing in the wind, and now he sensed the future as though it twisted across some surface as undulant and impermanent as that of the wind-blown kerchief. He saw people. He felt the heat and cold of uncounted probabilities. He knew names and places, experienced emotions without number, reviewed data of innumerable unexplored crannies. There was time to probe and test and taste, but no time to shape. The thing was a spectrum of possibilities from the most remote past to the most remote future, from the most probable to the most improbable. He saw his own death in countless ways. He saw new planets, new cultures, people. People. He saw them in such swarms they could not be listed, yet his mind catalogued them. Even the guildsmen. And he thought, the guild, there'd be a way for us, my strangeness accepted as a familiar thing of high value, always with an assured supply of the now necessary spice. But the idea of living out his life in the mind groping ahead through possible futures that guided hurtling spaceships appalled him. It was a way, though, and in meeting the possible future that contained guildsmen, he recognized his own strangeness. I have another kind of sight. I see another kind of terrain. The available paths. The awareness conveyed both reassurance and alarm. So many places on that other kind of terrain dipped or turned out of his sight. As swiftly as it had come, the sensation slipped away from him, and he realized the entire experience had taken the space of a heartbeat. Yet his own personal awareness had been turned over, illuminated in a terrifying way. He stared around him. Night still covered the still tent within its rock-enclosed hideaway. His mother's grief could still be heard. His own lack of grief could still be felt, that hollow place somewhere separated from his mind, which went on in its steady pace, dealing with data, evaluating, computing, submitting answers in something like the Mentat way. And now he saw that he had a wealth of data few such minds ever before had encompassed. But this made the empty place within him no easier to bear. He felt that something must shatter. It was as though a clockwork control for a bomb had been set to ticking within him. It went on about its business no matter what he wanted. It recorded minuscule shadings of difference around him, a slight change in moisture, a fractional fall in temperature, the progress of an insect across their still tent roof, the solemn approach of dawn in the star-lighted patch of sky he could see out the tent's transparent end. The emptiness was unbearable. Knowing how the clockwork had been set in motion made no difference. He could look to his own past and see the start of it, the training, the sharpening of talents, the refined pressures of sophisticated disciplines, even exposure to the OC Bible at a critical moment, and, lastly, the heavy intake of spice. And he could look ahead, the most terrifying direction, to see where it all pointed. I'm a monster, he thought. A freak. No, he said. Then, no, no, no! He found that he was pounding the tent floor with his fists. The implacable part of him recorded this as an interesting emotional datum and fed it into computation.
Paul!
His mother was beside him, holding his hands, her face a grey blob peering at him.
Paul, what's wrong?
You,
he said.
I'm here, Paul, she said. It's all right.
What have you done to me?
He demanded. In a burst of clarity, she sensed some of the roots in the question, said,
I gave birth to you.
It was, from instinct as much as her own subtle knowledge, the precisely correct answer to calm him. He felt her hands holding him, focused on the dim outline of her face. Certain gene traces in her facial structure were noted in the new way by his on-flowing mind, the clues added to other data, and a final summation answer put forward.
Let go of me,
he said. She heard the iron in his voice, obeyed.
Do you want to tell me what's wrong, Paul?
Did you know what you were doing when you trained me?
He asked.
There's no more childhood in his voice, she thought. And she said, I hoped the thing any parent hopes, that you'd be superior, different.
Different?
She heard the bitterness in his tone, said,
Paul, I...
You didn't want a son,
he said.
You wanted a Kwisatz Haderach. You wanted a male Bene Gesserit.
She recoiled from his bitterness.
But Paul,
did you ever consult my father in this?
She spoke gently out of the freshness of her grief.
Whatever you are, Paul, the heredity is as much your father as me.
But not the training, he said. Not the things that awakened. The sleeper.
Sleeper?
It's here.
He put a hand to his head and then to his breast.
In me. It goes on and on and on and on and Paul!
She had heard the hysteria edging his voice.
Listen to me, he said. You wanted the Reverend Mother to hear about my dreams. You listen in her place now. I've just had a waking dream. Do you know why?
You must calm yourself, she said. If there's...
The spice, he said. It's in everything here. The air, the soil, the food. The geriatric spice. It's like the truth-sayer drug. It's a poison.
She stiffened. His voice lowered and he repeated,
A poison. So subtle, so insidious, so irreversible, it won't even kill you unless you stop taking it. We can't leave Arrakis unless we take part of Arrakis with us.
The terrifying presence of his voice brooked no dispute.
You and the spice, Paul said. The spice changes anyone who gets this much of it, but thanks to you, I could bring the change to consciousness. I don't get to leave it in the unconscious where its disturbance can be blanked out. I can see it.
Paul, you...
I see it, he repeated.
She heard madness in his voice, didn't know what to do. But he spoke again, and she heard the iron control return to him.
We're trapped here.
We're trapped here,
she agreed. And she accepted the truth of his words. No pressure of the Bene Gesserit, no trickery or artifice could pry them completely free from Arrakis. The spice was addictive. Her body had known the fact long before her mind awakened to it. So here we live out our lives, she thought, on this hell planet. The place is prepared for us, if we can evade the Harkonnens. And there's no doubt of my course. A brood mare preserving an important bloodline for the Bene Gesserit plan.
I must tell you about my waking dream, Paul said.
Now there was fury in his voice.
To be sure you accept what I say, I'll tell you first, I know you will bear a daughter, my sister, here on Arrakis.
Jessica placed her hands against the tent floor, pressed back against the curving fabric wall to still a pang of fear. She knew her pregnancy could not show yet. Only her own Bene Gesserit training had allowed her to read the first faint signals of her body, to know of the embryo only a few weeks old.
Only to serve,
Jessica whispered, clinging to the Bene Gesserit motto.
We exist only to serve.
We'll find a home among the Fremen, Paul said. Your Missionaria Protectiva has brought us a bolt hole.
They've prepared a way for us in the desert, Jessica told herself. But how can he know the Missionaria Protectiva?
She found it increasingly difficult to subdue her terror at the overpowering strangeness in Paul. He studied the dark shadow of her, seeing her fear and every reaction with his new awareness, as though she were outlined in blinding light. A beginning of compassion for her crept over him.
"The things that can happen here I cannot begin to tell you," he said. "I cannot even begin to tell myself, although I've seen them. This sense of the future, I seem to have no control over it. The thing just happens. The immediate future, say a year, I can see some of that. A road as broad as our central avenue on Caladan. Some places I don't see, shadowed places, as though it went behind a hill." And again he thought of the surface of a blowing kerchief. "And there are branchings."
He fell silent as memory of that seeing filled him. No prescient dream, no experience of his life, had quite prepared him for the totality with which the veils had been ripped away to reveal naked time. Recalling the experience, he recognized his own terrible purpose, the pressure of his life spreading outward like an expanding bubble, time retreating before it. Jessica found the tent's glow tab control, activated it. Dim green light drove back the shadows, easing her fear. She looked at Paul's face, his eyes, the inward stare. And she knew where she had seen such a look before. Pictured in records of disasters, on the faces of children who experienced starvation or terrible injury. The eyes were like pits, mouth a straight line, cheeks indrawn. "It's the look of terrible awareness," she thought, "of someone forced to the knowledge of his own mortality." He was indeed no longer a child. The underlying import of his words began to take over in her mind, pushing all else aside. Paul could see ahead, a way of escape for them.
"There's a way to evade the Harkonnens," she said.
"The Harkonnens," he sneered. "Put those twisted humans out of your mind."
He stared at his mother, studying the lines of her face in the light of the glow tap. The lines betrayed her. She said,
"You shouldn't refer to people as humans without—"
"Don't be so sure you know where to draw the line," he said. "We carry our past with us, and mother mine, there's a thing you don't know, and should. We are Harkonnens."
Her mind did a terrifying thing. It blanked out, as though it needed to shut off all sensation. But Paul's voice went on at that implacable pace, dragging her with it.
"When next you find a mirror, study your face. Study mine now. The traces are there if you don't blind yourself. Look at my hands, the set of my bones. If none of this convinces you, then take my word for it. I've walked the future. I've looked at a record. I've seen a place. I have all the data. We're Harkonnens."
"A renegade branch of the family," she said. "That's it, isn't it? Some Harkonnen cousin who—"
"You're the Baron's own daughter," he said,
and watched the way she pressed her hands to her mouth.
"The Baron sampled many pleasures in his youth, and once permitted himself to be seduced. But it was for the genetic purposes of the Bene Gesserit, by one of you."
The way he said "you" struck her like a slap, but it set her mind to working, and she could not deny his words. So many blank ends of meaning in her past reached out now and linked. The daughter the Bene Gesserit wanted. It wasn't to end the old Atreides-Harkonnen feud, but to fix some genetic factor in their lines.
"What?"
She groped for an answer. As though he saw inside her mind, Paul said,
"They thought they were reaching for me, but I'm not what they expected, and I've arrived before my time, and they don't know it."
Jessica pressed her hands to her mouth.
"Great Mother! He's the Kwisatz Haderach."
She felt exposed and naked before him, realizing then that he saw her with eyes from which little could be hidden, and that, she knew, was the basis of her fear.
"You're thinking I'm the Kwisatz Haderach," she said.
Put that out of your mind. I'm something unexpected.
I must get the word out to one of the schools, she thought. The mating index may show what has happened.
They won't learn about me until it's too late, he said.
She sought to divert him, lowered her hands and said, We'll find a place among the Fremen.
The Fremen have a saying they credit to Shai-Hulud, Old Father Eternity, he said. They say, be prepared to appreciate what you meet.
And he thought, yes, mother mine, among the Fremen. You'll acquire the blue eyes and a callus beside your lovely nose from the filter tube to your still suit. And you'll bear my sister, St. Alia of the Knife. If you're not the Kwisatz Haderach, Jessica said, what?
You couldn't possibly know, he said. You won't believe it until you see it.
And he thought, I'm a seed. He suddenly saw how fertile was the ground into which he had fallen, and with this realization, the terrible purpose filled him, creeping through the empty place within, threatening to choke him with grief. He had seen two main branchings along the way ahead. In one, he confronted an evil old baron and said, Hello, grandfather. He thought of that path, and what lay along it sickened him. The other path held long patches of grey obscurity, except for peaks of violence. He had seen a warrior religion there, a fire spreading across the universe with the Atreides' green and black banner waving at the head of fanatic legions drunk on spice liquor. Gurney Halleck and a few others of his father's men, a pitiful few, were among them, all marked by the hawk symbol from the shrine of his father's skull.
I can't go that way, he muttered. That's what the old witches of your schools really want.
I don't understand you, Paul, his mother said. He remained silent, thinking like the seed he was, thinking with the race consciousness he had first experienced as terrible purpose. He found that he no longer could hate the Bene Gesserit, or the Emperor, or even the Harkonnens. They were all caught up in the need of their race to renew its scattered inheritance, to cross and mingle and infuse their bloodlines in a great new pooling of genes, and the race knew only one sure way for this. The ancient way. The tried and certain way that rolled over everything in its path. Jihad.
Surely I cannot choose that way, he thought.
But he saw again in his mind's eye the shrine of his father's skull and the violence with the green and black banner waving in its midst. Jessica cleared her throat, worried by his silence.
Then the Fremen will give us sanctuary?
He looked up, staring across the green-lighted tent at the inbred patrician lines of her face.
Yes, he said. That's one of the ways.
He nodded.
Yes. They'll call me Muad'Dib, the one who points the way. Yes, that's what they'll call me.
And he closed his eyes, thinking, Now, my father, I can mourn you. And he felt the tears coursing down his cheeks.
Book 2. Muad'Dib.
When my father, the Padishah Emperor, heard of Duke Leto's death and the manner of it, he went into such a rage as we had never before seen. He blamed my mother and the compact forced on him to place a Bene Gesserit on the throne. He blamed the guild and the evil old baron. He blamed everyone in sight, not excepting even me. For he said I was a witch like all the others. And when I sought to comfort him, saying it was done according to an older law of self-preservation, to which even the most ancient rulers gave allegiance, he sneered at me and asked if I thought him a weakling. I saw then that he had been aroused to this passion not by concern over the dead duke, but by what that death implied for all royalty. As I look back on it, I think there may have been some prescience in my father, too, for it is certain that his line and Muad'Dib's shared common ancestry. In my father's house by the Princess Irulan.
Now Harkonnen shall kill Harkonnen, Paul whispered. He had awakened shortly before nightfall, sitting up in the sealed and darkened still tent. As he spoke, he heard the vague stirrings of his mother, where she slept against the tent's opposite wall. Paul glanced at the proximity detector on the floor, studying the dials illuminated in the blackness by phosphor tubes.
It should be night soon, his mother said. Why don't you lift the tent shades?
Paul realized then that her breathing had been different for some time, that she had lain silent in the darkness until certain he was awake. Lifting the shades wouldn't help, he said. There's been a storm. The tent's covered by sand. I'll dig us out soon.
No sign of Duncan yet?
None. Paul rubbed absently at the ducal signet on his thumb, and a sudden rage against the very substance of this planet which had helped kill his father set him trembling.
I heard the storm begin, Jessica said.
The undemanding emptiness of her words helped restore some of his calm. His mind focused on the storm as he had seen it begin through the transparent end of their still tent. Cold dribbles of sand crossing the basin, then runnels and tails furrowing the sky. He had looked up to a rock spire, seen it change shape under the blast, becoming a low, cheddar-coloured wedge. Sand funneled into their basin had shadowed the sky with dull curry, then blotted out all light as the tent was covered. Tent bows had creaked once as they accepted the pressure, then silence, broken only by the dim bellows wheezing of their sand snorkel pumping air from the surface.
Try the receiver again, Jessica said.
No use, he said. He found his stillsuit's water tube in its clip at his neck, drew a warm swallow into his mouth, and he thought that here he truly began an Arakeen existence, living on reclaimed moisture from his own breath and body. It was flat and tasteless water, but it soothed his throat. Jessica heard Paul drinking, felt the slickness of her own still suit clinging to her body, but she refused to accept her thirst. To accept it would require awakening fully into the terrible necessities of Arrakis, where they must guard even fractional traces of moisture, hoarding the few drops in the tent's catch pockets, begrudging a breath wasted on the open air. So much easier to drift back down into sleep. But there had been a dream in this day's sleep, and she shivered at the memory of it. She had held dreaming hands beneath Sandflow where a name had been written, Duke Leto Atreides. The name had blurred with the sand, and she had moved to restore it, but the first letter filled before the last was begun. The sand would not stop. Her dream became wailing, louder and louder, that ridiculous wailing. Part of her mind had realized the sound was her own voice as a tiny child, little more than a baby. A woman not quite visible to memory was going away.
My unknown mother, Jessica thought. The Bene Gesserit who bore me and gave me to the sisters because that's what she was commanded to do. Was she glad to rid herself of a Harkonnen child?
The place to hit them is in the spice, Paul said.
How can he think of attack at a time like this? She asked herself. An entire planet full of spice, she said. How can you hit them there?
She heard him stirring, the sound of their pack being dragged across the tent floor.
It was sea power and air power on Caladan, he said. Here it's desert power. The Fremen are the key.
His voice came from the vicinity of the tent's sphincter. Her Bene Gesserit training sensed in his tone an unresolved bitterness toward her.
All his life he has been trained to hate Harkonnens, she thought. Now he finds he is Harkonnen. Because of me. How little he knows me. I was my duke's only woman. I accepted his life and his values, even to defying my Bene Gesserit orders.
The tense glow tab came alight under Paul's hand, filled the domed area with green radiance. Paul crouched at the sphincter, his stillsuit hood adjusted for the open desert, forehead capped, mouth filter in place, nose plugs adjusted. Only his dark eyes were visible, a narrow band of face that turned once toward her and away.
"Secure yourself for the open," he said, and his voice was blurred behind the filter.
Jessica pulled the filter across her mouth, began adjusting her hood as she watched Paul break the tent seal. Sand rasped as he opened the sphincter, and a bird fizzle of grains ran into the tent before he could immobilize it with a static compaction tool. A hole grew in the sand wall as the tool realigned the grains. He slipped out, and her ears followed his progress to the surface.
"What will we find out there?" she wondered. "Harkonnen troops and the Sardauka? Those are dangers we can expect. But what of the dangers we don't know?"
She thought of the compaction tool and the other strange instruments in the pack. Each of these tools suddenly stood in her mind as a sign of mysterious dangers. She felt then a hot breeze from surface sand touch her cheeks where they were exposed above the filter.
"Pass up the pack."
It was Paul's voice, low and guarded. She moved to obey, heard the water litajons gurgle as she shoved the pack across the floor. She peered upward, saw Paul framed against stars.
"Here," he said, and reached down, pulled the pack to the surface. Now she saw only the circle of stars. They were like the luminous tips of weapons aimed down at her. A shower of meteors crossed her patch of night. The meteors seemed to her like a warning, like tiger stripes, like luminous grave slats clabbering her blood. And she felt the chill of the price on their heads.
"Hurry up," Paul said. "I want to collapse the tent."
A shower of sand from the surface brushed her left hand.
"How much sand will the hand hold?" she asked herself.
"Shall I help you?" Paul asked.
"No."
She swallowed in a dry throat, slipped into the hole, felt static, packed sand rasp under her hands. Paul reached down, took her arm. She stood beside him on a smooth patch of starlit desert, stared around. Sand almost brimmed their basin, leaving only a dim lip of surrounding rock. She probed the farther darkness with her trained senses. Noise of small animals. Birds. A fall of dislodged sand and faint creature sounds within it. Paul collapsing their tent, recovering it up the hole. Starlight displaced just enough of the night to charge each shadow with menace. She looked at patches of blackness.
"Black is blind remembering," she thought. "You listen for pack sounds, for the cries of those who hunted your ancestors in a past so ancient only your most primitive selves remember. The ears see. The nostrils see."
Presently Paul stood beside her, said,
"Duncan told me that if he was captured, he could hold out this long. We must leave here now."
He shouldered the pack, crossed to the shallow lip of the basin, climbed to a ledge that looked down on open desert. Jessica followed automatically, noting how she now lived in her son's orbit.
"For now is my grief heavier than the sands of the seas," she thought. "This world has emptied me of all but the oldest purpose, tomorrow's life. I live now for my young Duke and the daughter yet to be."
She felt the sand drag her feet as she climbed to Paul's side. He looked north across a line of rocks, studying a distant escarpment. The faraway rock profile was like an ancient battleship of the seas outlined by stars. The long swish of it lifted on an invisible wave with syllables of boomerang antennae, funnels arching back, a pie-shaped upthrusting at the stern. An orange glare burst above the silhouette and a line of brilliant purple cut downward toward the glare. Another line of purple. And another upthrusting orange glare. It was like an ancient naval battle, remembered shellfire, and the sight held them staring.
"Pillars of fire," Paul whispered.
A ring of red eyes lifted over the distant rock. Lines of purple laced the sky.
Jet flares and laser guns,
Jessica said. The dust-reddened first moon of Arrakis lifted above the horizon to their left, and they saw a storm trail there, a ribbon of movement over the desert.
It must be Harkon and Thopters hunting us, Paul said, the way they're cutting up the desert. It's as though they were making certain they stamped out whatever's there. The way you'd stamp out a nest of insects.
Or a nest of Atreides,
Jessica said.
We must seek cover, Paul said. We'll head south and keep to the rocks, if they caught us in the open.
He turned, adjusting the pack to his shoulders.
They're killing anything that moves.
He took one step along the ledge and, in that instant, heard the low hiss of gliding aircraft, saw the dark shapes of ornithopters above them.
My father once told me that respect for the truth comes close to being the basis for all morality. Something cannot emerge from nothing, he said. This is profound thinking if you understand how unstable the truth can be. From Conversations with Muad'Dib by the Princess Irulan.
I've always prided myself on seeing things the way they truly are. That's the curse of being a Mentat. You can't stop analyzing your data.
The leathered old face of Thufir Hawat appeared composed in the pre-dawn dimness as he spoke. His sappho-stained lips were drawn into a straight line, with radial creases spreading upward. A robed man squatted silently on sand across from Hawat, apparently unmoved by the words. The two crouched beneath a rock overhang that looked down on a wide, shallow sink. Dawn was spreading over the shattered outline of cliffs across the basin, touching everything with pink. It was cold under the overhang, a dry and penetrating chill left over from the night. There had been a warm wind just before dawn, but now it was cold. Hawat could hear teeth chattering behind him among the few troopers remaining in his force. The man squatting across from Hawat was a Fremen who had come across the sink in the first light of false dawn, skittering over the sand, blending into the dunes, his movements barely discernible. The Fremen extended a finger to the sand between them, drew a figure there. It looked like a bowl with an arrow spilling out of it.
There are many Harkonnen patrols.
He lifted his finger, pointed upward across the cliffs that Hawat and his men had descended. Hawat nodded. Many patrols, yes. But still he did not know what this Fremen wanted, and this rankled. Mentat training was supposed to give a man the power to see motives. This had been the worst night of Howard's life. He had been at Tsimpo, a garrison village, buffer outpost for the former capital city Carthag, when the reports of attack began arriving. At first he thought, it's a raid. The Harkonnens are testing. But report followed report. Faster and faster. Two legions landed at Carthag. 5 legions, 50 brigades, attacking the Duke's main base at Arrakeen. A legion at Arsunt. 2 battle groups at Splintered Rock. Then the reports became more detailed. There were Imperial Sardaukar among the attackers, possibly 2 legions of them. And it became clear that the invaders knew precisely which weight of arms to send where. Precisely. Superb intelligence. Howard's shocked fury had mounted until it threatened the smooth functioning of his Mentat capabilities. The size of the attack struck his mind like a physical blow. Now, hiding beneath a bit of desert rock, he nodded to himself, pulled his torn and slashed tunic around him as though warding off the cold shadows. The size of the attack. He had always expected their enemy to hire an occasional lighter from the guild for probing raids. That was an ordinary enough gambit in this kind of house-to-house warfare. Lighters landed and took off on Arrakis regularly to transport the spice for House Atreides. Hawat had taken precautions against random raids by false spice lighters. For a full attack, they'd expected no more than 10 brigades. But there were more than 2,000 ships down on Arrakis at the last count. Not just lighters, but frigates, scouts, monitors, crushers, troop carriers, dump boxes.
more than 100 brigades, 10 legions. The entire spice income of Arrakis for 50 years might just cover the cost of such a venture. It might. I underestimated what the Baron was willing to spend in attacking us, Howard thought. I failed, my Duke. Then there was the matter of the traitor. I will live long enough to see her strangled, he thought. I should have killed that Bene Gesserit witch when I had the chance. There was no doubt in his mind who had betrayed them. The Lady Jessica. She fitted all the facts available.
Your man Gurney Halleck and part of his force are safe with our smuggler friends.
Good.
So Gurney will get off this hell planet. We're not all gone. Howard glanced back at the huddle of his men. They had started the night just past with 300 of his finest. Of those, an even 20 remained, and half of them were wounded. Some of them slept now, standing up, leaning against the rock, sprawled on the sand beneath the rock. Their last thopter, the one they'd been using as a ground effect machine to carry their wounded, had given out just before dawn. They had cut it up with laser guns and hidden the pieces, then worked their way down into this hiding place at the edge of the basin. Hawat had only a rough idea of their location, some 200 kilometers southeast of Arrakeen. The main travelled ways between the Shield Wall CH communities were somewhere south of them. The Fremen across from Howard threw back his hood and stillsuit cap to reveal sandy hair and beard. The hair was combed straight back from a high, thin forehead. He had the unreadable total blue eyes of the spice diet. Beard and mustache were stained at one side of the mouth, his hair matted there by pressure of the looping catch tube from his nose plugs. The man removed his plugs, readjusted them. He rubbed at a scar beside his nose.
If you cross the sink here this night, you must not use shields. There is a break in the wall.
He turned on his heels, pointed south.
There, and it is open sand down to the Erg. Shields will attract it. Worm, they don't often come in here, but a shield will bring one every time.
He said worm, Howard thought. He was going to say something else. What? And what does he want of us? Howard sighed. He could not recall ever before being this tired. It was a muscle weariness that energy pills were unable to ease.
Those damnable Sardauka!
With a self-accusing bitterness, he faced the thought of the soldier fanatics and the imperial treachery they represented. His own Mentat assessment of the data told him how little chance he had ever to present evidence of this treachery before the High Council of the Landsrat, where justice might be done.
Do you wish to go to the smugglers?
Is it possible?
The way is long.
Fremen don't like to say no, Idaho had told him once.
You haven't yet told me whether your people can help my wounded.
They are wounded.
The same damned answer every time.
We know they're wounded. That's not the peace,
friend. What do your wounded say? Are there those among them who can see the water need of your tribe?
We haven't talked about water.
I can understand your reluctance. They are your friends, your tribesmen. Do you have water?
Not enough.
The Fremen gestured to Howard's tunic, the skin exposed beneath it.
You were caught in CH without your suits. You must make a water decision, friend.
Can we hire your help?
The Fremen shrugged.
You have no water.
He glanced at the group behind Howard.
How many of your wounded would you spend?
Howard fell silent, staring at the man. He could see as a Mentat that their communication was out of phase. Word sounds were not being linked up here in the normal manner.
I am Thufir Hawat. I can speak for my Duke. I will make promissory commitment now for your help. I wish a limited form of help, preserving my force long enough only to kill a traitor who thinks herself beyond vengeance.
You wish our siding in a vendetta?
The vendetta I'll handle myself. I wish to be freed of responsibility for my wounded, that I may get about it.
The Fremen scowled.
How can you be responsible for your wounded? They are their own responsibility. The water's at issue, Thufir Hawat. Would you have me take that decision away from you?
The man put a hand to a weapon concealed beneath his robe.